Bankruptcy.
Chapter 3. Mr. Bagthorpe's bank overdraft turned out to be only in three figures as usual. He was not comforted by this. "The damage has already been done," he asserted. "I have suffered an irreversible trauma, and shall never be the same again. I am either schizophrenic or paranoic, or both. I am not certain. I shall have to consult my Lang. In either case, the roots of my malady certainly lie within the family itself." At first the family did not believe this, but when the widening rings of his schizophrenia began to impinge on their own lives, they were forced to take more serious note of his claim. There could be little doubt that Mr. Bagthorpe, for whatever reasons, was now in the grip of a fully developed, all-out obsession. The form this obsession took was what Tess described as a Scrooge complex. "He has focused all his subconscious anxieties into one," she told the others. "He has tried to simplify his personal neuroses by converting them into something with which he feels he can cope. Money." "But Father can't cope with money," Rosie pointed out. "You know he can't." "But his anxieties have at least been externalized," Tess explained. Nobody had the least idea what she was talking about. "If you read much more Jung and Lang, you will go the same way yourself," William told her.
"What is Lang?"
I guess they're, like, psychologists or psychiatrists who write books. Yeah. I'm not sure. "You will go the same way yourself," William told her. "I think that you have more inherited genes from Father than any of us. That is a poor lookout." Mr. Bagthorpe astounded everyone by telling Mrs. Fosdyke, just before lunch, that she could go home. "Take the afternoon off," he told her. "But I ain't poorly," Mrs. Fosdyke objected. "And what about the washing up? And what about the blancmange for tea?" "We shall deal with washing up and the blancmange," he told her. She was clearly stumped. Nothing like this had ever happened before. Knowing Mr. Bagthorpe as she did, Mrs. Fosdyke viewed this gesture of apparent magnanimity with the darkest suspicion. "He's up to something," she told Madames Pye and Bates later, over her stout. "You mark my words, there's more in this than meets the eye." "Could be that he's unhinged by being bankrupted," suggested Mrs. Pye with relish. "You did say he was bankrupted, didn't you, Glad?" "Oh, definite," Mrs. Fosdyke assured her. She went on to say that what she believed was that Mr. Bagthorpe was trying to ease her gradually into redundancy.
Redundancy?
Firing her. "Which you ain't allowed to do," she said. "Not these days. And even if you do, you've got to give a silver handshake."
A silver handshake?
Money, I guess. Mrs. Fosdyke was not far off the truth in her prognosis, except that Mr. Bagthorpe was not intending to give her a golden, silver, or any other kind of handshake on her departure. Not even one of the ordinary variety, if he could avoid it. He had never made any secret of his dislike of Mrs. Fosdyke, and if any cuts were to be made, then clearly her services must be dispensed with as soon as possible. "We can no longer afford Mrs. Fosdyke," he told them all, after her departure, in what seemed to them unreasonable dudgeon. "She is a luxury. Not only do we have to pay her wages, but she is day after day wearing out my carpets with her perpetual hedgehogging about with the vacuum, and moreover has inflated ideas about what kind of meals we can afford. We cannot afford beef. We cannot afford rich pastry and pork pies. Tess, you will kindly make the blancmange for tea, and use half milk and half water." "But I don't know how," Tess protested. "Then learn," he told her tersely. "Read the instructions on the packet. We are now beginning to find the chinks through which the winds of the world howl." No one could make anything of this latter obscure utterance, other than it did seem to indicate that Mr. Bagthorpe's mind had become, at least temporarily, deranged. Mrs. Bagthorpe tried to humor her husband by agreeing that their diet was perhaps too rich, and that in the interests of both health and economy it should possibly be simplified. "But as to dispensing with the services of Mrs. Fosdyke," she said, "I really cannot agree. You will remember, Henry, how disrupted the household became in her absence earlier this summer." "This household is going to be disrupted," he told her. "The four horsemen of the apocalypse are going to drive a coach and pair right through it, and Mrs. Fosdyke will be trampled down in the process." "I have not the least idea what you are talking about, Henry," said his wife, becoming tight-lipped. If necessary, I shall pay for Mrs. Fosdyke's services out of my own money. I, too, am a breadwinner, and must be allowed some say in the management of things." "You do as you like," he told her, "but I warn you, I shall cut off the electricity at the mains at 8 o'clock each morning." An electrified silence followed this stark pronouncement. "I do not think I quite heard you, Henry," said his wife at length. "I think you did," he returned. "There will be nothing to prevent people filling flasks with hot drinks if they feel that they cannot get through the day without them, and there are, of course, methods of cooking which require nothing more than a bag of straw or a sandpit or something. We shall use these methods in the future." At some time Mr. Bagthorpe had evidently read articles on self-sufficiency, and was now drawing on confused memories of these. "We could always have salad every day," suggested William, with an attempt at sarcasm, "like the sainted aunt." "There is no way this family will eat salads with tomatoes at the price they are," said Mr. Bagthorpe stringently. "When we have grown our own salad stuff, then we shall eat it." "Oh, dear!" Mrs. Bagthorpe felt quite helpless. "I already have a row of cause lettuce," he continued, "and one of spring onions. There is also, I believe, some beetroot and rhubarb. We shall have to exercise our ingenuity with these ingredients." The Bagthorpe sat and bleakly pondered the prospect of such a diet. "Go and fetch your grandmother, dear," said Mrs. Bagthorpe to Rosie, sotto voce. Mr. Bagthorpe heard. "There is nothing mother can do," he told his wife. "This is my household. If she prefers to go and live with Claude or Celia, then that is her affair. If she went to Celia's, she could live on caviar and gin." Grandma, when the situation had been outlined to her, did not, in fact, opt for either of these alternatives. She scented a good deal of excitement and conflict ahead. "I shall simply have a hamper of food sent from Fortnum and Mason each week," she announced. "Will you commence this absurd policy before the visit of Lucy or after?" "We shall commence it forthwith," he said. "If there is one thing that can be said for Aunt Lucy, it is that she admires determination and strength of character. She will observe a good deal of both these qualities during her stay." "But what about being immortal?" Rosie wailed. "What about getting famous before that horrible Luke does? If we're all washing pots and digging and sowing seeds, how can we do our strings to our bows?" "That is enough of that kind of talk," her father told her sternly. "What this family is now concerned with is survival. The whole world is ranged up out there against us. We shall shore up our defenses against it. We shall become, in fact, totally self-sufficient. Only when we have achieved that shall we become free."
"But, Henry, I feel free already," cried Mrs. Bagthorpe desperately. "Why do you not take the afternoon off and go for a nice long walk?"
"Because I never go for long walks," he replied. "As you know full well, Laura, I detest long walks. I shall spend the afternoon tilling the soil, and then this evening I shall draw up a rota of duties for the whole household."
"Pray do not put me down for anything," Grandma requested. "I am too old to be caught up in this sort of hocus-pocus. Wisdom, I am happy to say, comes with age."
"Bilge, mother," Mr. Bagthorpe told her. "You have never been wise, nor are you now. Age has simply compounded your unreason. The day you get to be wise will be the day cows fly, and we shall, of course, have to get one."
"Why will we?" demanded Tess.
"Because," he told her, "we shall require milk. Milk is necessary for bones and teeth and so forth. We can have a cow, or we can have a goat. You can take your pick."
"Who'll milk it?" Jack asked.
"You, probably," replied Mr. Bagthorpe. "The time has come when you're going to have to pay the way of that mutton-headed hound of yours. What does he cost to feed? What contribution does he make to this benighted household? There is no room for drones in this hive."
There was nothing much that Jack could say in reply to this, because Zero did not, in fact, do much about the house, not even frighten off burglars.
"He makes money," Jack said stoutly, "and he doesn't cost you anything, father. He gets free buried bones, remember? Anyway, I don't mind milking a goat, as long as somebody shows me how to do it."
"And who will that be?" inquired Tess. "Can you milk a goat, father?"
"There is no doubt a perfectly good manual on the subject," he told her, unperturbed. which is more than Robinson Crusoe had the benefit of. Where is your spirit of adventure?"